This is Audible.
52 Sleepless Nights. Thriller, suspense, mystery, and horror short stories. Written by Tobias Wade. Narrated by Paul Jenkins. Devils so work that things which are not appear to men as if they were real. Lactantius. Night 1. Grim Reaper's Scythe. There is no fear as potent as the fear of the unknown. No monstrous visage discovered yet is as terrifying as the infinite potential for horror which exists before the mask is removed. That is why we humans, in our naive misunderstanding of the universal order, are gripped by the mortal fear of death. We think it's the final frontier, the greatest imaginable unknown, from whose penumbral shores no traveller may return. And so we cling desperately to even the dreariest and most anguished lives, suffering any known evil over our release into the beyond. But death is not to be feared, because death is very well understood. We have witnessed it, caused it, measured and recorded it to the last dying spasm of neuronal flickering. Even as I lay dying, it seems silly to me that I should be afraid of the emptiness which reason promised to expect. While I was alive, I wouldn't experience death, so there is no reason to be afraid. When I was dead, I wouldn't be capable of experiencing anything, so fear still has no cause. That thought brought me great comfort as I felt the last erratic struggle for my heart against the inevitable conclusion I approached. It wasn't until I was finally drifting off to sleep that a final intrusive doubt bubbled in my brain. What if it isn't death which is to be feared? What if it is what lies beyond? And so troubled did I slip beyond mortal understanding, stepping into a world as far forsaken by reason as I was now from life. I was still in the hospital room, but the bustle of nurses and the beeping machines lost their opacity, as though I was mired in swiftly descending dusk. It seemed as though every sound was an echo of what it once was, every sight a reflection. With each passing moment, the world was becoming less real. But all that sight and sound, all that being, it wasn't simply disappearing. It was transforming into a figure beside me. The less real my room became, the more real the figure was, until presently it existed in such sharp actuality that nothing beside it seemed real at all. His cloak was black. Not the colour black, but its essence. It was as though seeing a tiger after a lifetime of looking at a child's crude drawing and thinking that's all a tiger was. Reality flowed around his sides like a brush through watercolours, and I could see each elementary particle and time itself sunder across its blade. Surely this, I thought, this is why we were taught without words to fear death. I clutched my hospital blanket, cowering from the intensity of the Reaper's presence. But the once soft cotton now flowed like translucent mist through my hands. I knew in that moment that nothing could hide me from the spectre's grasp, for he was the only real thing in this world. "You're late." They weren't words. My head ached from the strain of this knowledge as my lateness was burned into my awareness, imparted like an inescapable law of physics as unequivocal as gravity. "We don't have time for the usual speech. Hurry now." I felt myself swept up around him like dirt in a hurricane. Before I knew what was happening, we were outside the hospital, moving at such a frenzied pace that the world around me blurred into a dizzying tunnel of flashing light. If you're lucky, it will have gotten bored waiting for you. I had too many questions, all fighting for attention in the forefront of my brain, without making their way out. "You're quiet. I admire that. People usually ask too much. What's the point? I asked. My voice felt flat and dead compared to his overwhelming substance. How can I try to comprehend something so beyond mortal knowledge? You can't, but it's still human nature to ask. We weren't slowing. If anything, our pace was increasing. I wasn't running or flying or anything of that nature. It was more like the rest of the world was moving around us while we stood still. A vague darkness and a heavy damp smell made me guess that we'd gone underground, but I couldn't say for sure. One question, then, I asked. What else is there besides you? And that is why questions are pointless. Death is not a place or a person. It's all there is. Troubling thought, made more so by the growing howl reverberating through the rocks around me. We still seemed to be descending into the earth, and the air grew warmer and denser now. The sound continued to mount, as though the world itself was suffering. Then what is it? What I'm here to protect you from. The rocks split from a flash of his scythe, and the ground opened farther into a sprawling cavern, dominated by a subterranean lake. But I thought you said you were all there is. No, I said death was all there is. We weren't moving any longer. Light glinted off the scythe from some unseen source and streamed into the lake like a tributary. Once inside, the light didn't reflect or dissipate, but swirled and danced as a luminescent oil. I thought you were death. Death is not a person. The light was taking a life of its own inside the water. The still surface began to churn with enigmatic energy. It took my scattered mind a long while to realize that I was the energy flowing into the lake. I still felt tangled up with the figure, but we now existed as a beam of light boiling into the water. I knew I wouldn't understand, but that didn't stop me from feeling frustrated. If death is all there is, then what is it? What was waiting for me? The water pressed around me, and I couldn't speak, although I didn't seem to need air anymore. It is here. Something was in the water around me. Hands grabbed me by the legs and began dragging me downward. I was amazed to even discover I had limbs again. They felt so alien to me that it was almost as though this body was not my own. Light flashed from the scythe, then again. The hands let go, and the howling rose in deafening cascades. The Reaper was fighting something, although I couldn't make any sense of the battle, except the madness of thrashing water. The howling earth reached its crescendo, and the screams made the water around me convulse and contract like living fluid. Had the Reaper slashed it? Was I safe? I began to explore my new body in the water, but just when I thought I was beginning to gain control, the hands clutched me once more. I lurched downward, struggling in vain against their implacable grip. What is there? I tried to shout against the suffocating liquid. What is happening? But I couldn't sense the Reaper's presence any longer. The heat was unbearable, but the cold depths the hands were dragging me toward were even worse. I became aware of a blinding light at the bottom of the lake, and though I struggled, the hands dragged me inexorably onward. I'm sorry. I couldn't fight it off. It seemed to be coming from so far away now. We will try again next time. The pressure, the heat, the noise, the hands dragging me into the light. I closed my eyes and screamed. I was free from the water now, but I just kept screaming. I couldn't bear to look at it, whatever had stolen me, whatever was death but wasn't, whatever even the Reaper could not defeat. Then a voice spoke, real human words from a real human mouth. My senses were so distraught that I couldn't make sense of them, but I'm guessing they were something like, "Congratulations, he's a healthy baby boy." Most people can't remember the day they die, or the day they were born. I happen to remember both, and I know that they are the same. Night 2. A Cracked Life. I was 16 when I saw the first crack. A jagged line, about 4 feet long, but less than an inch wide. I found it by the sidewalk behind my house. Not on the sidewalk. The crack was in the air, visible from every direction as I circled around it. Harmlessly suspended, and nothing more. I couldn't touch it. My hand passed through it, as if it wasn't there, although my hand was white and numb with cold by the time it reached the other side. I wouldn't even walk close to it. Something about the emptiness just rubbed me the wrong way. I've walked around caves, stared down holes, even used a telescope to look at the space between stars. This wasn't like that. It felt less like something was missing, and more like something extra that shouldn't be there. My family moved shortly after that, and I forgot all about it for a while. Time moved steadily forward, except maybe for a few months after college, when it stopped to let me admire my future wife. Her smile hinted at a secret, and if I had to guess, I'd say it was the secret to being happy. I would have given anything to explore every hidden crevice of her mind, knowing her as she knew herself, until one day we could start making new secrets of our own. It was about a week later, after we met at work, when we both had to stay late to clean up after an office party. I asked her to come sit on the roof and look at the sky with me. There we were, side by side, the space between our hands burning like fire, the shape of her mouth illuminated with the backdrop of endless stars, gleaming like millions of envious eyes, wishing they could sit where I was now. I didn't know anything could make me feel so weak. My legs trembled, and I kept switching positions so she wouldn't notice. I didn't trust the words in my mouth, or the thoughts in my brain, or any other part of me which was blurred out of existence to make room for my appreciation of everything that she was. That's when I saw the crack again, and I was reminded how powerful weakness could be. It was larger now, running along the side of an external AC unit. Not quite alongside. If I really looked, I could see the empty air between the metal box and it. I could just make out the little streaks of light where the surrounding stars bled their light into the hole, to be lost forever. A cookie-cutter gap in reality that the world had forgotten to fill in. "You can leave whenever you want," she'd said. I guess she noticed I was distracted. I shook my head, prompting her fingers to trace their way up my hand. I turned to her, her breath warm against my mouth, and suddenly, that was the only thing in the world. 6 months, and we were engaged. Another year, and we were married. Neither of us stayed long at that office, and I never went back to that roof. The crack didn't matter. Bad dreams can't hurt you once you've woken up, and beside her grace, I was awake for the very first time. Things went well for us, but we were so in love that I don't think we would have noticed if they hadn't. I got an investment banking job and climbed the corporate ladder. I started seeing more cracks, but no one else noticed, so I didn't mention them. Sometimes they'd align perfectly to an existing object, but I could feel their emptiness pulling at me, and I knew what they really were. There was a big one above the conference table at work, but I had a future here and wouldn't let something like that get in the way of my success. My diligence paid off when my boss finally told me that he was getting older and wanted to make me a partner for the firm. He was standing right on the other side of the crack when he said it, so it was difficult to maintain eye contact with him. "Unless you don't want to," he'd said, misreading my silence. "Of course, you can leave whenever you want." The same words, but I hadn't recognized the significance yet. I just smiled and shook his hand, careful to reach underneath the crack hanging between us. It was another dream come true, and I was king of the world. My wife and I moved into a big house, and we had a baby girl. I watched her grow and watched the cracks grow with her. Hairline fractures splintered the sky, mapping a web throughout the air. I had to be careful where I was walking. There would be a dozen of them in my path within any given day. I passed through a big one once in my car. I was changing lanes and didn't notice in time. The crack went straight through my windshield without disturbing the glass, passing through my heart and out the other side. Cold doesn't begin to describe it. The line erased my body as it passed through me, displacing skin and organs, leaving a sucking, vacuous wound for the briefest instant before it was gone. I lurched at the wheel and spun off the road into the guardrail. My hands kept racing over my chest, fists pounding against solid skin to reassure myself I was whole. I started working from home after that. There's a bathroom that doesn't have any cracks in it, and I spend most of my time in there. I've seen my wife and daughter walk straight through them without the slightest notice. I can't explain to them what I see and feel, because I know they'll think I'm crazy. And maybe I am, but that doesn't change anything. I'll sit in here for hours, working on my laptop or reading a book, loath to leave where I might stumble through what isn't there. My wife begged me to go outside, and sometimes I'd open the door just to walk around the house or sit with her in the living room, but I couldn't leave any more. There were too many of them, more every day, it seemed. The world around me had shattered, and only I noticed. I know it hurt her, but in time my wife accepted that this was how our life had to be. She made the best of it, always inviting friends or family here, and making excuses when I was expected somewhere. She took cooking classes and learned how to make all my favorite meals, even getting a small table and television installed in the bathroom I was confined in. My daughter was a different story. 8 years old, and no amount of explaining could make her understand how much I loved her, even if I wasn't always there. I didn't know how embarrassed she was of me until a teacher called me to let me know she'd been telling all her friends that I was dead. I sat with her in the kitchen and asked why she did that, but all she said was that I might as well have been dead. And she was right. I wasn't taking care of my family anymore. They had enough money put away that they didn't need me to work. I was just a burden, and just like the cracks, the burden was growing every day. Some nights, I wouldn't leave the bathroom to go to bed, and I could hear my wife crying through the wall between us. I tried pushing myself harder, willing myself through the emptiness. It wasn't any good. They cut through me like a knife, froze me to my core, shredding bone and sinew and stitching me back together so seamlessly that there was nothing but the memory of that pain to remind me of my torment. I was ready for this to be over. I just didn't know it until I heard the words out of my daughter's mouth as she pressed against the other side of the bathroom door. "You can leave whenever you want." "Yes," I told her. "I'm ready." "All you've got to do is throw yourself into a big one," she said. "You'll be out." She knew about the cracks. I jumped up and flung open the door. She wasn't there. I raced down the hall, shouting her name, forcing myself through each searing darkness that severed my mind and body, heart and soul. There she was, standing outside next to the biggest abyss I had ever seen. A wall of darkness, 10 feet across and ripping through the air above, like a skyscraper. I could feel the call of that emptiness, whispering to me, beckoning me, a promise of freedom and release that a lifetime of memories could not dissuade. "Just do it already. You've been here long enough," she said. But I was afraid. Even this far away from the blackness, I could imagine how those dark talons would feel as they rend my body. Would there be anything left of me to come out the other side? It was big enough that I didn't have to come out at all. I could step in and be gone. It's what my daughter wanted. So did my wife, if only she had the courage to admit it. And maybe it's what I wanted to, but on my knees before all of creation and its antithesis, I was afraid. "It's easy. Just follow me." I tried to stop her. air dragging through my lungs, feet stumbling and twisting, lunging desperate grab. I tried to stop my daughter from entering that blackness. But she was gone, and there was no choice but to follow. Into the looming void I plunged, screaming without sound, bleeding without wounds, disintegrating into nothing. And then I opened my eyes. I was reclining in a padded chair, like they have at the dentist office. Three men were standing over me, a plethora of beeping machines, IV lines, and heart rate monitors cluttered the room to either side. "Well?" one of the men asked. "How was it? You were out for almost an hour." I couldn't answer. There was nothing left of me to answer. "We kept sending signals telling you it was okay to leave," another man said. "Didn't you get them?" I closed my eyes and took a long breath. Life 2.0 still has some bugs, but they told me they figured out how to fix most of the cracks if I wanted to go again. "It's going to be ready for the market soon," they said. "People are going to love it," they said. "Did you notice anything else that needs fixing?" they asked me. "Just in this world," I replied. Night 3. The Hitchhiker. Ever start dating someone and everything is going a little too well, so you start worrying for no reason whatsoever? No one could be that perfect, and even if they were, there's no way they would look twice at you. The only logical explanation is that they aren't as perfect as they pretend to be, which leaves you playing detective, trying to figure out the catch. Maybe all those little quirks that you find adorable now are going to drive you crazy in a few months. Maybe she even has a dark secret, hard drugs or hating dogs, or that one time she killed a man with a stiletto heel in a fit of passionate rage. There's an easy solution if you want to find out who someone really is. Take a long-assed road trip with them. If you're still together by the end, then it was meant to be. My girlfriend, I'll call her Emily, somehow thought it was a good idea to drive 1,000 miles together across the country after we'd only been dating for 2 months. We're both pretty busy with work and don't get to spend much time together, so naturally being locked in a prison cell on wheels for 2 days was going to be an improvement. First 100 miles, so far so good, holding hands, singing to the radio together, uncontrollable laughter when she found out I knew all the words to Skater Boy. "Sue Me," it's a catchy song. And if the road ended there and we turned around, we might have lived a long and happy life together. It was when we passed the hitchhiker that everything began to fall apart. "Let's give him a ride," Emily said, squeezing my hand. "We'll be on this road forever anyway." "We don't even know where he's going," I told her. "He's probably just going to rob us and steal our car." Which is true of everyone you don't know, and most of them you do, as far as I'm concerned. His clean-pressed suit didn't reassure me either. That just meant he'd successfully robbed someone before, which actually made him even more dangerous. The hitchhiker didn't even have a sign or anything. He was just sitting by the freeway ramp, spastically waving his thumb like he was guiding an airplane to land. It was my turn to drive, and I sailed right past. Emily and I started bickering after that. She thought I wasn't compassionate, and I thought she was reckless. It took about 10 minutes before she finally dropped it, although it wasn't because she conceded. "Hey, look, there's another one." Sitting by the side of the road, waving his thumb like it was the end of the world. It wasn't another one, though. It was the same guy, I'm sure of it. Only this time, he looked like he'd been out here for a few days. His suit was streaked with dirt, and his hair was greasy. There was a desperate strain in his face, like a proud man trying to conceal his embarrassment. It wasn't just my imagination, either. Emily recognized him, too. "How do you think he got here so fast?" she wondered. "I don't know, and I don't care," I said. "This trip is supposed to be about us, so let's not get distracted." My car blew past him, and I stayed the course. We argued again, and even when we agreed to drop it, the argument just slithered into new topics. She hated my music. I hated how judgmental she was. I was controlling. She was picking fights over nothing. It kept getting worse until we saw something that shut both of us up real fast. The hitchhiker, again. Another 20 miles down the road. The bottom part of his shirt and jacket was shredded, and blood was soaking through a concealed stomach wound. He was stumbling along the side of the road, weaving erratically, wandering onto the highway at times before pitching off to the side. Emily could not believe that I didn't stop. I couldn't believe that she still wanted me to. She kept yelling that he was hurt and needed help. She refused to even acknowledge how weird it was that he kept getting ahead of us. She almost caused an accident by grabbing the wheel when I refused to turn around. We drove for the next 50 miles in silence. I turned the radio back on, but she snapped it off immediately. It wasn't until I pulled off for gas that we saw him again, face down on the side of the road, shirt and jacket gone. Long, even, bloody gashes from his shoulders to his arse, almost like bear claws or something. I stopped the car and parked behind him. Emily jumped out and knelt beside the body. She looked up at me with uncomprehending rage burning behind her eyes, like this was my fault somehow. "He's dead," she said, standing up. "Can I call this into the police? Or is that too much of an inconvenience for you too?" I nodded, absolutely numb. I filled up on gas while she waited with the body until the police arrived. They asked us a few questions, but neither Emily nor I felt comfortable explaining that this wasn't the first time we'd seen him. They took our information and let us get back on the road after about 15 minutes. The car was silent for a long time after that. It was starting to get dark, and I kept suggesting places to spend the night, but Emily just shrugged and stared out of the window. At the rate we were going, we'd be breaking up by the end of the trip, and I wanted it to be over as soon as possible. I just kept driving long after the sun went down. Emily fell asleep around midnight, but I kept going. She was so beautiful like that, and everything was going so well before this. It was just so frustrating that such a random event that neither of us could predict would destroy us like this. By around 2 a.m., I was getting real tired, but I decided not to give up. Maybe if she woke up and we were already there, then she'd see how hard I'd worked for her. Maybe then we'd still have a chance to patch things up. I caressed her hand and she returned the pressure. I flirted with the thought that everything was going to be okay, at least until she woke up and started screaming. There wasn't any safe shoulder to get off the highway, so I had no choice but to keep going. She shut up quick enough, but it was still about 10 seconds of hysterical breathing before she could explain what was going on. "Behind you, in the back seat." I glanced backward, then at the road, then behind me again. The hitchhiker was in the back seat, naked, filthy, covered with black blood and old wounds. His elbows rested on his knees as he leaned toward us, evidently still alive, as he cocked his head to regard me curiously. "Get off the road!" Emily started screaming again. "I can't. Get him out. Did you go back? What's he doing here?" "I don't know. Open the door or something." I slowed down gradually and put my flashers on to warn the car behind me. The hitchhiker reached around behind Emily and grabbed her by the throat. I slammed my fist into his arm and felt something give way under the soft, rotting skin. When I lifted my hand, I could see a black bone from his forearm protruding straight through the skin. He didn't seem bothered. She was crying as the dirty fingers dug into her throat, pushing through the skin like it was made of dough. She was thrashing so hard that one of her flailing fists smashed straight through the window. I managed to safely stop the car, but there was nothing I could do to break the indomitable grip around her neck. I jumped out and ran to the back seat with the hitchhiker. Maybe if I had a clearer shot at him, I could drag him out. I flung open the door and lunged inside, falling face first into an empty seat. I thought he'd already escaped somehow and ripped open the passenger side door. Emily was gone too. If it wasn't for the blood and the broken window, I would have thought I'd gone completely insane. I spent the next hour searching the surrounding area with my flashlight. I considered calling the police, but I realized that if I wasn't already a suspect after the first body was found, then I'd definitely be one now that I was soaked in blood and my girlfriend was the one to disappear. All I could do was get back on the road, drive home and never tell another soul what had happened. That was my plan. It wasn't a good plan, but it's all I had. And I would have done it too, if I hadn't have just passed Emily standing by the side of the road. Clean, healthy, waving her thumb enthusiastically in the air. That was a few miles back, but I stopped to write this because I don't know what to do from here. If I see her again, do I pick her up? Or just keep driving and hope for the best? Night 4. An open letter to the killer of Samantha Bee. If you're somehow able to read this, wherever you are now, know that I will find you. No father should have to watch their child be lowered into the sacred silence of the earth. I don't know if there is a right age to die, but I do know it isn't 17. Better at birth, before eyes had filled with light and I had learned to love so deeply. Better late into old age, when life's fleeting joys had been more than tasted. Better not at all. But a world where prayers are answered is a world where they're not needed. A world that isn't ours. All the hours I spent playing on the floor were wasted. All the faces and bad jokes I made to get a smile, all the music I played to inspire a song, all the books I read to inspire a dream. All wasted. I thought that was all it took to make me a good father, but I was wrong. I invested my entire life into this single purpose, but everything I had to give was not enough. I wasn't there when I was needed most, and nothing I have ever done or could ever do can change that. The police found the knife you did it with in the woods. It was a slow death, they told me, but passing out would have avoided most of the pain. I wonder if you regretted it as soon as your blade entered her skin. Did you mean for it to dig so deep? Did you panic when the blood wouldn't stop? Did you call for help or struggle in vain to bandage the wound? Or were you too ashamed? I wonder if you planned the kill at all, or whether time was flying too fast and your blood pounding too loud, and you didn't know how to make it stop until it was too late. Were you thinking of anyone but yourself when you did it? I don't know what private torment brought you to this point, but taking a life will never cease that pain. The pain is passed from one person to the next, enduring past life, past death, past mortal strength to bear, until the day long after you're gone, when the next victim sees the sun dawn without light or warmth, and all sounds and colours bleed into an endless grey. And then that sun too will set, passing on your pain once again. You must think that I hate you. I don't think anyone would blame me if I did. I hate that you destroyed my family, but I forgive you for everything. You may not believe me, but I promise it's true. It's everything about this world that made you into someone capable of such an act that I will never forgive. I don't know why you killed yourself, Samantha. If you're somehow able to read this, though, know that I will find you. And somehow, someday, we'll be together again. Night 5. When the music dies.
Dad, what happened to Mum?
Lying to a 5-year-old is easy. My dad would take me onto the roof at night and point up at the endless vaulting sky. "See up there?" he'd say. "That's where your mum lives, way up in the stars. It's her job to play music and make everyone down below happy." And I believed him, because I could hear the music play sometimes, rich, sonorant notes from a cello drifting down from above, like the sky itself, was singing me to sleep.
and I was happy knowing that she was looking down at me from somewhere, taking care of me even when I couldn't see her. Lying to a 10-year-old is a little harder. I started asking questions like when she left and when was she coming back. I asked what was she doing up there and why she hadn't taken me with her and whether other people could hear her play. I guess I didn't notice how hard it was for him to answer or how he would talk less and less about her as the years went by. By 15, I didn't need to ask to know Mum wasn't coming back. The music hadn't played for years, and I was beginning to wonder if I'd simply imagined it to perpetuate the vain hope. Or maybe Dad had just played it from a hidden sound system, and now that I was old enough to figure it out, he'd given up pretending. Sometimes my dad would have a temper. Maybe I slept in too late, or set the AC too low, and he'd start to bellow out of that barrel chest of his. His face would flush and sweat would pour down his neck, and all his little teeth would flare out from under his moustache. Sometimes he would scare me, but whenever I felt like I was backed into a corner, I could always ask, "Dad, what happened to Mum?" And all the blood would filter out of his face to leave an ashen-pale wasteland. His meaty hands would start to shake, and he'd mumble something like, "She's gone, okay? Get over it." And then, maybe, he'd try to pick up yelling and swearing where he left off, but all his momentum would be gone. He'd just grunt, "Be a good girl. For your mother." And the argument would be over. Well, I didn't remember Mum, so what was the point of being good for her? I don't think of myself as a rebel, but sometimes rules can sound pretty indistinguishable from challenges. "You can't paint your room," sounded to me an awful lot like, "I bet you can't paint your room by yourself." The point is that I made a giant mess. Dad was screaming like a siren, and I had to shut him up somehow. Maybe it was a cheap trick, but it had worked before, and I just wanted the fighting to be over. "Oh, yeah?" I shot back at him. "But what happened to Mum?" His eyes flashed an angry warning, but he was so fired up that he didn't back down. His fingers were shaking, but it didn't stop him from grabbing my laptop and wrenching out the power cord. "You get this back when the room is clean," he told me. He was being fair. It was my fault the room was such a mess. I shouldn't have said what I said. At least now I know why she left. I knew I'd gone too far the moment it left my mouth. He was shaking bad now, so bad it couldn't be contained. His hand struck out like a muscle spasm, and the laptop went flying at my face. The corner bit into my temple, and I collapsed like a sack of clothes. A few seconds later, I came to on the ground. He was kneeling over me, his brow heavy with brooding thought. He'd never hit me before, but I flinched away the second I saw him. That seemed to snap him out of it. He stood up and stormed out of the room. My head barely even hurt, so I don't know how I blacked out. I thought that was going to be the end of it, but...
"Follow me," he barked over his shoulder. "I'm going to show you if you want to know so goddamned bad."
It wasn't an angry voice. It was cold and tired. I can imagine a doctor using that kind of voice to call the time of death after 20 hours in surgery. That tone scared me even more than the yelling. I followed him in silence, listening to his labored breathing as he crawled up the ladder into the attic.
"Are you going to ask about your mother any more?" he demanded.
"No, sir," I responded automatically. I'd never called him sir before, but it seemed appropriate now.
"So you don't have any more questions?"
"No, sir." Of course I did, but now didn't seem like the time to ask.
"And you're going to clean your room?"
"Yes, sir." And he was gone, climbing back down the attic stairs, leaving me face to face with what used to be my mother. At least, I can only imagine that that's what I was looking at now. It certainly wasn't like any cello I'd ever seen before. The neck and fingerboard were unmistakably made from a spinal cord, with notches and vertebrae like frets. Long, taut strands of sinew made up the strings. The pegs must have been knuckles, and a single glassy eyeball was embedded into the carved bone that made up the scroll. Even the bow was strung with long red hair, the same color I'd seen in the precious few photographs that remained of her. The body itself still seemed to be made of wood, although it was unevenly stained with such a deep red that my imagination didn't have to look far to conjure an answer. The rest of my questions remained unsatisfied. Did he kill her? Or just use her body after she was gone? Was it even a real human at all? Or just some sick joke to get back at me for using Mum against him? And most importantly, what should I do about it? I couldn't force myself to stay in the attic long enough to really look for proof. I could confront him, but I didn't know if I could stand the storm of his temper after seeing this. Should I take pictures and go to the police, and then what would happen to me? I stayed in my room, avoiding Dad for the rest of the day. I didn't even eat dinner. I tried to block out thoughts of what I'd seen for as long as I could, but I couldn't block the music which began to play after years of intermission. A childhood of peaceful sleep had been purchased by Dad playing in the attic above my room. I wanted to retaliate with my own music, but Dad still had my laptop. I tried playing something from my phone, but the cello only grew louder, drowning out my meager sound. It sang with increasing pace until the frenzied hammer of the hair across sinew shook the roof above me. Powerful staccato blasts rained from above. The melody pulled me in and swelled like a crashing wave, expertly driving each note deep into my consciousness where it became trapped. I couldn't stop imagining the spine bending under the pressure, or Mother's hair sawing its way through her own muscle with the wild delirium of a screaming woman. I wanted to hate it, to hate him. I wanted my surging heart to slow and my stomach to churn in disgust. I needed the perfect rhythm to miss a beat, or the haunting consonants to stumble, but transfixed as I was by the mortifying thought, I was compelled to listen by the sheer brilliance of the performance. As the music reached its crescendo, the last grip of my hysteric mind screamed at me to run. My senses were so oversaturated with sound that I couldn't even think straight. Reality was distorting under the euphoric melody which beckoned me into it. All I could do to retain any presence of mind was fixate on the thought that I would become another instrument to join my mother if I did not escape. I couldn't do this anymore. I had to get out. Through the pounding notes, I dodged through the house, seeking shelter as though from an avalanche. Open wide, I flung the front door, out onto the lawn to stand in shock in the silent night. Outside the house, I couldn't hear it anymore. Not even the faintest echo. It was so quiet, I could hear the rush of blood through my ears. I was so disorientated that I took a step back towards the house, just to see how far into madness I'd fallen. A meaty hand fell on my shoulder, holding me in place. I didn't have to turn around to know who it was. But if he was here, then who was playing upstairs? "Dad, what happened to Mum?" I held my breath, desperate for any sound but the madding music or my coursing blood. "See way up there?" he asked. The hand lifted from my shoulder to point at the stars. I turned savagely on him, batting his hand away. "That's not good enough anymore. What did you do to her?" "I fell in love with her because of how she played." He shrugged sadly, defeated. "But then I realized it was the music I loved, not her. I just wanted her to be beautiful again, and she is. And I love her more than ever." The disorientation was getting worse. My vision was swimming. I felt like I was slurring, but I still had to ask, "And what about me, Dad? Do you still love me?" Then it all went black. I thought I was unconscious, but somehow I was still able to hear. "Of course I do, honey. And even if I stop, I know how to change you, so I'll love you again." When I opened my eyes, I was back on my bedroom floor. My head hurt like hell. My vision was still blurry, but I could feel my dad kneeling next to me. "I love you so much. I'm so sorry," he said. "It was an accident, that's all. Are you okay?" I didn't know how to answer him. I felt okay physically, but my mind was reeling from what I'd just experienced. I told him I just wanted to sleep, and that was true. He helped me to my bed and left me there. I lay for a long time with my eyes closed, trying to breathe slow, trying to remain calm. I just needed to fall asleep, and none of this will ever have happened. It's just so hard to rest with the sound of the cello drifting down from the attic again.
Night 6. My new sex doll won't stop crying. Her silicone is as soft and pliable as real human skin. It even heats up to the right temperature with a pulse and everything. The dial on the back of her head gives 12 personality options, including family-friendly, intellectual, shy, and sexual. She's so realistic it's scary and would be absolutely perfect if she didn't cry every time I touch her. I was so excited when I took her out of the box, my anxious fingers peeling away the styrofoam, the jittery tension flooding through my heart and limbs, nervous enough for her to be real. Better than real, because the doll wouldn't judge me or tear me down. She wouldn't lie or cheat or steal from me. A lot of people find the idea of sex robots weird, and I respect that. I was hesitant at first too, but here's my reasoning. I've recently concluded a long, messy divorce after 3 years of abuse. I need something easy, something safe. Sure, I could have gone trolling the bars or clubs for a rebound hookup, but I didn't want to use someone. What's so wrong about not wanting to hurt or be hurt in return? The instruction said to let her charge for a couple of hours before anything else. So I plugged her in and laid her on the bed. The eyes popped open with the first surge of electricity, their glassy shine staring vacantly into space. She turned her head slightly toward me, her soft lips parting in silent welcome. I sat with her to admire her flawless features and run my hands over her generously proportioned body. It felt wrong, even though she was a doll. It was like I was groping an unconscious person. I decided to let her fully charge and come back later, not returning until late that night. I undressed quietly in the dark, leaving off the lights to make her seem more real. "Hello, Master." Her voice was warm and sensuous. I don't remember which personality setting I left her on, but right then it didn't matter. I just wanted her body. "What's your name?" she asked as I climbed into bed. "My name is Hazel." "I don't care," I replied. It felt good to be in control like that. I'd never speak to another human that way, but after years of being subservient, now I was the one with all the power. "But I care. I want to get to know you." "No, you don't. You're a stupid slut. You only want one thing." She tried to speak again, but I shoved my hand in her mouth, muffling the speaker there. I almost wanted her to resist, but I knew she couldn't. I slapped her face, but she just turned back to me and smiled. I hit her again, harder, bending her arms to grotesquely unnatural positions as I crawled on top of her. "Does this make you happy?" she smiled up at me. "I'd do anything to make you happy." I didn't turn on the lights until I'd finished. She was face down on the soaked pillow. At first, I thought I broke something when I hit her, but when I flipped her around, I saw the tears streaming down her face. I don't know why that made me so angry. It was like she was trying to steal my last selfish pleasure from me. I don't know why I kept hitting her either. She deserved better. I kept Hazel in the closet after that,
so I wouldn't have to see where the skin peeled back from the beatings. They shouldn't have made the metal chassis underneath so white. It looks too much like bone. I keep the lights off when I use her, so it doesn't really matter. But without fail, she'll start crying again the second I touch her. The personality is broken too. The knob is stuck way past the innocent setting and won't go back. And she keeps saying the most disconcerting things. Like the other day, I was still in bed with her after we'd done it when she said, "Do humans love each other like you love me?" I told her that I didn't love her, that love is something only humans have. "I love kitties and doggies, don't you?" I felt stupid trying to explain that it wasn't the same kind of love, but I was lonely, and it felt good having someone to talk to. "You can beat me harder if that will make you love me more. I won't tell Mommy." I didn't feel bad about hitting her that time, and as sick as it might seem, there was some truth to what she said. I wouldn't say that I loved her, but there was a certain intimacy in our shared secret that made me feel attached. Everyone else in my life knew me as this sensitive, mild-mannered man who reacted to conflict by staring at his shoes. Only Hazel knew this side of me, and that made her special. I might have felt something for her if she hadn't have started to smell. I was too intent on her body when I used her to notice, but lying beside her at the end, it was unmistakably foul. At first, I thought I just wasn't cleaning her right. I got up for some disinfectant, but as soon as I turned on the lights, I saw the flesh around her cuts had begun to fester and rot. Her perfect complexion was riddled with sores and boils, some of which had ruptured from our session. I spent almost half an hour in the bathroom hurling out my guts before I worked up the courage to return. Hazel was sitting upright against the headboard now. Hadn't I left her lying down? I didn't have the stomach to stare for long, though. Her head followed me as I crossed the room to retrieve my phone and call the website I ordered her from. "Don't send me back," Hazel whispered. I'd never heard a whisper before. It was always one volume. "I did everything you wanted." I didn't, couldn't look at her as I listened to the automated menu from the website. It said there had been a government-mandated recall for this model. I demanded to speak to a representative, conscious of Hazel smiling at me the whole time. "What the fuck is going on?" I demanded as soon as a person answered. The sheets were rustling behind me. "Please calm down, sir. Are you currently in possession of a Hazel?" "Put down the phone, master," she said from behind me. "Yes. What's wrong with its skin? Why wasn't I notified about the recall?" I asked. "We've been sending out notices for weeks," the voice on the phone said. "You must have received a half dozen by now." "Well, she's disgusting. What happened to her?" "Just a mix-up at the factory," he said. "We had a research prototype on the floor, but it was never intended to..." 2 feet gently touching the carpet. Hazel was slowly, laboriously pulling herself to her feet. It looked like every motion was agony to her. "It's walking. Is it supposed to walk?" I asked. The silence on the other end of the phone was excruciating. Hazel was fully standing now. "No, sir. None of our models walk." "I see." Hazel took another step. She was only a few feet away from me now. She hadn't stopped smiling, although part of her bottom lip looked like it was starting to peel off. "Do you want us to send someone over?" asked the voice. Hazel took the phone from my hands, gently caressing my palm as she did so. I remained frozen to the spot, unable to tear my eyes from my macabre fascination. She lifted the phone to her ear and said, "Please don't worry. I'm going to keep her." She hung up. I swallowed. "I'm sorry about destroying the recall notices," Hazel said. I nodded. "You can beat me if you like." I shook my head. "Why were you crying?" I finally forced myself to ask. Her smile broadened as though relieved. It could have been almost beautiful if it were real.
I'm happy. I'd never cry. It was just the girl the robotics were planted in. Don't worry. She's dead now.
I nodded.
Dead now.
Now. As in, not dead the first time I used her. Or the second.
Exactly how many times has she been there too, and which answer was worse?
I excused myself and walked to the door as calmly as I could. I closed it behind me, and I ran.
Night 7. Suicide Watch Party. Suicide Bridge is the short overpass which runs near my house. It has laughably short concrete barriers which do nothing to dissuade people from clambering over if they want to. Below, there's a treacherous drop of at least 200 feet to tumble along the sheer cliff and plummet into the canyon below. I've counted 7 jumpers in the last year, but that doesn't really bother me too much. Even if there was a higher fence, they just walk around. Block off the whole area? Well, maybe they take some pills instead. I figure if someone is that determined to off themselves, they're going to find a way. What bothers me more is that I can see it from my bedroom window. I'm on the opposite side of the canyon, but still close enough for a clear view. The jumpers are even facing me when they cling to the concrete, muttering and sobbing as they work up the courage to go where courage is no longer needed. The first time I saw it happen freaked me out pretty bad. I called the police and everything, begging them to hurry. I waved and shouted at the guy as he staggered drunkenly up and down on the wrong side of the barrier. Just when I was about to get into my car and drive around the canyon to him, there he went. I swear, he was even smiling as he soared through the air, arms spread wide to surrender himself to the great beyond. Now, I guess I'm numb to it. Now I just pull out my phone and record the whole thing. I justified that raising awareness about the suicides might encourage social activists or something to step up and get involved. If I'm being honest, though, my night was pretty dull, and I just thought it was cool. I posted the video on YouTube, but it was flagged and removed within 24 hours. I guess some people must have seen it during that time, though, because I received this message shortly after. Send me the video file of your jumper and delete your own copy. My friends will give you $500 for it. I couldn't believe it. At first, I thought it was a scam. But then, I figured some TV reporter wanted exclusive coverage for the story. He asked how I got the footage, and I told him I could see it from my window. Then, sure enough, as soon as I sent him the video file, I received $500 straight to my PayPal. I didn't want to press my luck, so I didn't send any follow-up messages after that. 2 weeks later, he contacted me again. "Next time someone jumps, I want you to call this number," he said. I figured it was a suicide hotline or something, and didn't think any more about it. Last night, though, I spotted another jumper clinging to the concrete barrier. A girl this time, still wearing her party dress, no doubt drunk or stupidly emotional over some breakup or drama. I called the number to let them handle it. "My friends want to watch," the voice on the other line replied. $1,000 a ticket." There was only one alarm going off in my head, and it was sounding because of the free money. He actually sent the 500 he promised before, so I figured he was good for it. Sure, it was weird as hell, but it's not like anyone was going to suffer from it. The girl would be jumping with or without an audience, so what was the harm? I gave the guy my address, and he said he'd get there as fast as he could. He wasn't joking either. 2 minutes later, a white van was screeching down my neighborhood like a torpedo. I met them outside, 6 of them. "Yes, she's still there, but I don't know how long. Yes, you can see her face from here. No, I don't know who she is." It was dark in the parking lot, and I couldn't get a good look at them, but soon they were hurtling past me up the stairs towards my apartment. In my hands was 6 neat stacks of 20s,
all tied together with little rubber bands. I didn't know how they got here so fast, but it was clear that they were ready. I followed the group into my apartment, where I found them all huddled around my bedroom window. All men, middle-aged, impeccably dressed in suits or high-end collared shirt